KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. If you had 5 minutes on stage, what would you talk about? How would you say it? That's the premise of Ignite Seattle, a regular event where presenters get 5 minutes and 20 PowerPoint slides to tell a story. It began in 2006, and ever since, hundreds of talks have been given around the world in New York, Sydney, Portland, and Seattle, among other locations. Speakers at Ignite Seattle 20 touched on a variety of topics, including busking in Pike Place Market and teaching children how to fail. The event took place at Town Hall on May 16, 2013. It was moderated by Seattle Times columnist Monica Guzman. The first speaker is Whitney Monger.
All right, so my name's Whitney Monger, and I'm going to tell you my story about busking in the Pike Place Market. How many people here have been to the Pike Place Market? Everyone. Great, that's what I want to see. So I'm sure you've encountered a performer down there, and the term that we like to use is busking. A busker is a person who performs in public for money. And we have many names, street performer, troubadour, or my favorite, attention whore. So you're probably wondering, how do you get this profession? I moved to Seattle in 2008, and I lived in this place called the Stewart House, which is in the heart of the Pike Place Market. And I would listen to performers day in and day out playing outside of my window. And I've been playing music for over 10 years, and I didn't think I was any good. So I finally went down and had the courage to ask a performer, and I said, hey, how do I become a busker? And he said, well, all you need is a permit. And I was like, wow, that's easy. So I went down to the Pike Place Market office and purchased a $30 annual permit. And in turn, they gave me a pass, and they showed me all the spots I could play and a rule book of what I can and can't do. So right now I'm going to tell you just simple tips that I've learned to be successful at busking. One thing I want to emphasize is spot location. That's like probably one of the most important things. Although there are 15 spots you can play in the market, there are really only three that you will make a lot of money at, and that's Starbucks, the Bridge, and where they throw the fish called the Clock. And the reason being is because these spots are covered. Exactly. And it's because of the weather in Seattle. It rains a lot. So if you have a rainy day and you're in an uncovered spot, you won't make as much money. Another thing that I've learned is to dress the part. This works in many facets of life, but specifically in street performing, it's important to wear your Sunday's best. And you know, something that I've learned is to have merchandise, have a nice case display, have, you know, look like you're ready to make money. I can't tell you how many times I see performers down there with a closed case. It's very strange. But have a case open, have CDs, you have t-shirts, sell them. And then something that I like to do to keep myself on my toes is to learn new songs. Do not play Stairway to Heaven over and over again. It will not create a lot of tips. Yes, exactly. It's very important to play songs that the crowd knows or things that mean something to you. And obviously you guys know that busking is a very strange job. It's not your typical 9-to-5. There's no 401k. There's no retirement plan, and it's very inconsistent. In fact, that's the only thing consistent about it, is inconsistency. And there's many things that can change whether or not you will be successful that day, whether it's the weather, tourist season, the time of day, where you decide to play. I mean, all of these things can change whether or not you make $5 or $200. And so another thing you have to deal with is public scrutiny. It's true. Most of the time, the tourists that come down to the market have never seen a street performer in their life, and the people that they have seen are normally homeless. And so a lot of the times people will underestimate you and think that you're kind of a loser and this is your last resort. And it's true, they really do. So, I mean, you have to have thick skin to do this job. It's very difficult to make a difference. And then another thing, if you play drums, if you play trumpet, or if you play keyboards, or you have a big band, you cannot play in the Pike Place Market. I am sorry. It's a restriction. You can play anywhere else in Seattle, but the Pike Place Market does not allow it. And lastly, you know, busking is professional. It's a professional gig. You can't, it's not American Idol where being bad or, you know, kind of knowing what you're doing will get you famous. You have to have a skill and a craft. It's definitely a professional job. In fact, one of the oldest professions that there is. So, it takes a lot of courage to busk. And that's what my whole story is about is, I mean, you have to be able to put yourself out there and be vulnerable and fall on your face and pick yourself back up. And I would have never guessed 5 years ago that this would be my livelihood. I swear to God, I had no idea that this was going to be the thing that I would do. And in turn, I mean, amazing opportunities have arisen for me from doing this alone. And it's all because I took a chance. My music is played internationally because I don't know if you know this, but over 4 million people go to the Pike Place Market annually. And I play to a lot of those people. So, I mean, I've worked with some of the best musicians in Seattle. I've played on some of the best stages, and it's all because I took a risk. So I encourage you, if you've ever thought about busking, if you've ever wondered about it, go get your $30 permit. Check it out. It could be your career. If you're ever curious about me and my music and what I'm up to or where I'll be playing, you can always visit my website or follow me on Twitter. Thank you.
Thank you, Whitney. Well, a lot of people change their careers, and Nathan Kaiser, our next speaker, has some lessons that he learned from his career in tech that he is applying to his career in booze. Nathan.
All right, I'm Nathan Kaiser. Pleasure to meet you all. By the way, my beautiful wife is right over there. Yeah. So I started Two Bar Spirits, a local craft distillery in Soto. And the name itself comes from my family's ranch in South Texas. These are some of the photos here. And I'm going to get back to the importance to me in a little bit. That's actually my grandfather and my father on the ranch. thank you. I get a little verklempt when I see it as well. My dad's like, take that offline. So I started in tech about 14 years ago. Jumped from medical into tech about 2 to 3 months before the market collapsed, which was great timing. But I've been in tech ever since. And who here is in tech? Who's in startup specifically? Yeah, I figured it'd be well represented. What I'm about to share about with tech is by no means thought-provoking, anything insightful, or intelligent. It's just bloody hard, right? Would you guys agree? Right? Come on, a little bit more. It's harder than that. Thank you. And, you know, you can go get a paycheck. You can work for somebody and call it good, play golf at 3:30. You can't do it in startups, and you can't do it in tech. And it's just bloody hard. And so the reason the epiphany that I had for me personally was, why the hell am I doing this? And it comes down to something very simple, right? And it's the why. And this kind of gets me a little bit, but it's the why. Why am I doing something? And how rarely that has anything to do with the what. So I ran a company. This is my beautiful wife and our two boys, by the way, and I'm behind schedule on these slides. The why has nothing to do with the what. I ran a company called EndPost, where it was a job board, but it had nothing to do with the why. We connected people to one another. I worked at a great company called Blue Box, which provides web hosting, had networks and servers and all this stuff. But again, nothing to do with the why. That had to do with, really simple, providing peace of mind to our customers. So that brings me to Two Bar Spirits. So Two Bar is something for me that's amazingly the best fun I've ever had, the hardest work I've ever done, and it has something very simple. It draws back to my family heritage and history with this ranch, where 5 generations of my family have worked the land. My grandfather was born on it. I get a little verklempt. Still lives on it at 82, and this is my homage to that family heritage, to that history, to giving back to something that they've created and just scratched and toiled and teared and bled to make work. And that's what I'm trying to embody with Two Bar Spirits. So the why has nothing to do with the what. The other thing with booze, another why, if you will, is that, do you guys know what booze is about? I'm good on time. What? It's about celebrating moments in time that can never be repeated again, with people that you will never share that moment in time with again. And it's about enjoying that. It's about relishing it. It's about just taking it for everything it's worth. And that's the same for food. That was my wife's laugh, by the way. It's about food, wine, booze, and everything. And that's what we're trying to create here. We're trying to create a company we're 100% local, all made on site, that embodies that degree of community, that degree of connectedness, and allows people to celebrate with the people they love what's truly important. And, you know, I get now Facebook posts, and we're only 6.5 months old, so we're really new. But people are posting these photos of our spirits at their family reunions, at their dinners with their friends. And it's just the most empowering thing you could possibly imagine, and what gets me up every morning to make this stuff. And if you've never had moonshine, you need to. It's delicious. And they're serving it, by the way, this little plug downstairs, in a ginger moon. And so N. Kaiser on Twitter and Tubar as well. So thanks so much, and get drunk.
Thank you, Nathan. At one point or another, just about every day, we would like people to do what we want them to do. Our next speaker, Nicole Steinbach, is going to tell you a little bit about her art of persuasion. Come on, Nicole.
I'm a program manager at Microsoft, so logically that means two things. I don't program software, and I don't manage people. So in order to get my ideas into software, I have to pitch every day to people who can actually create stuff, developers and testers. This is a lot easier if people like you and trust you. So when you meet someone, you need to do a Care Bear stare, which is sending love and happiness towards them. If you're human, it's a lot better to do this from your heart and also not to have a constipated look upon your face. Next, when you start talking to people, instead of being interesting, be interested in them by asking them questions and being genuinely curious about things that they care about. Next, in order to get someone to trust you, you need to trust them first. For example, I took my son to work one day, and suddenly I needed to go to a meeting, so I asked a coworker to look after him. So now he knows that I trust him, and I got free childcare. Win-win. When you want something valuable, this seems obvious, but you need to ask for it, and it works a lot better if you ask nicely. Next, explain the benefits to you, your team, the world. It's a lot easier to say yes when you know why. And also, flattery often works. Now, I'm sure you're all working on amazing and awesome things, but sometimes boring shit happens or has to happen. So how do you get people to do it? Well, first, if you can, eliminate it. Next, if you're like me and not a creator, do it for the people who actually create stuff. Then make it way easier than this pie is. Seems a little complicated to me. The next thing you can do is shock people. So I got this email from my manager, and it was entitled, "Free Tickets to Hawaii." I read it immediately, I laughed, and then I completed the boring survey he wanted me to fill out. Caution, you have to use this sparingly. Next, Mary Poppins was right. In every job that is to be done, there's an element of fun. So find that for people. And if all else fails, bribe them. It's amazing what busy, well-paid people will do for free food. The hardest person to motivate is often myself. So of course, I joined a cult. And I want all of you to join this cult with me. It's the cult of done. Bing it, read it, love it, join it. It's fantastic. Next, you need to eliminate distractions. Close your door, close Twitter, close Facebook, close email. But you're thinking, my job is email. Turn it offline. Make sure you get those Outlook or email notifications off. They're very distracting. Do not multitask. Our brains are not CPUs. We are not good at context switching. Super focused people or super successful people focus on one thing at a time. Exception, maybe jugglers. So what next? Everything's going really well. So you probably want a new job. In marketing, there's the 4 P's. Pitching yourself is so important. There are 14 P's. First of all, you need to make yourself make sure you're pitching for the right job by looking at the position, people, product triangle and figuring out what is important for you on each of these axes. When I first started out, I thought cool products was the most important thing, but now I realize that cool people are. And so that's something that I really focus on when I'm looking for a job. Next, you need to prepare. You need to use the product or investigate the area that you're looking at and have some sort of opinion. Next, pre-reference. References available on request is so 2002. Use LinkedIn and Facebook and get someone to do that pre-introduction for you. Personal hygiene, have to have it. Do not, when you go to the interview, smell good or at least don't smell bad. It's very awkward to hire someone whose name you can't pronounce, so make sure they can pronounce it or give yourself a nickname. Make sure you punctuate your superpower at the interview, at the beginning and at the end of it, because that's what people remember most. And show your passion throughout by asking great questions. Next, once you have all that down, you need to practice and practice and practice to get better. Just like in baseball, you can't pitch a perfect game without a ton of practice. So you can practice with friends and your mentors, but once you're actually done practicing, maybe you actually want to do it for real. So if your triangle looks like that, except maybe you're a bit more tech-focused and you're an amazing developer, the OneNote team wants to hire you. If your triangle looks like that, you're a bit more tech-focused, you're an amazing developer, and you notice there weren't 14 Ps, our test team wants to hire you. So email me at NicoleT@Microsoft or come talk to me after. Also, Andrew Cherry over there is wearing a OneNote shirt. He could be your next boss. Always be pitching, everyone. Thank you.
Nicole Steinbach, who spoke last month as part of Ignite Seattle. Her talk was called Everyday Pitches. In this segment, you also heard from Whitney Manger and Nathan Kaiser. The 20th Ignite Seattle event took place at Town Hall on May 16, 2013. It was moderated by Seattle Times columnist Monica Guzman. The next Ignite event is scheduled for August. You can learn more and hear the entire hour of this talk, as well as a list of speakers, by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Allie Ferguson recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Ignite Seattle in a moment, 824 94.9 KUOW. As United Nations officials look to resettle some of the more than 1 million people who fled the war in Syria, Canada's immigration minister says Canada will participate, but warns the real answers lie elsewhere. We'll hear about that later this evening. Also, a resident of Canmore, Alberta, talks about filming the flooding in which his neighbors are watching their homes collapse into a deluge. And a study from Boston University that indicates that silver could be ideal in fighting bacterial infections. All three of those items tonight at 11. Stan Freberg is a well-loved humorist and satirist of radio and television. He's won three Emmys, a Grammy, and 21 Clio Awards for his funny commercials. He has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. He's been honored in the Radio Hall of Fame, the Songwriters Hall of Fame, and the Animation Hall of Fame. He's also one of the founders of the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences. His autobiography is It Only Hurts When I Laugh. That covered the first half of his career. He's now working on the final volume. Stan Freberg will be our guest tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Weather outlook for the Seattle area for tonight, lows in the 50s and rain. Friday highs somewhere in the 60s, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers. And Friday night, lows in the 50s, partly cloudy. Then Saturday, things will brighten up and warm up a bit. Highs lower to mid-70s and mostly sunny skies.
KUOW and the Fry Art Museum present Buster Simpson, Surveyor, a retrospective exhibition of work by Seattle artist Buster Simpson, a pioneer in the field of environmental and public art that provokes civic awareness and dialogue, June 15th through October 13th. More on the events page at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Ignite Seattle is a regular event where speakers get 5 minutes on stage to tell a story. The submission guidelines for speakers are fairly straightforward. Tell us something you're passionate about. On May 16th, 2013, Town Hall hosted the 20th Ignite Seattle. In the next segment, speakers talk about stalking strangers online, urban farming, and teaching children how to fail. The event was moderated by Seattle Times columnist Monica Guzman.
Our next speaker does something pretty interesting for a living. Carmen Hudson is going to tell you how she stalks strangers online. Carmen.
So that was a perfect precursor to my speech. So there is a tech talent shortage. There are not enough great engineers that do the big important things like allow us to do online banking accurately. People with computer science degrees, people who know how to build algorithms. In fact, the numbers tell us that there are 40,000 open jobs, almost 0% unemployment among these folks, and there are only 49,000 computer science students totally. So that means even if we hired every single computer science grad, we'd still have a gap of 28,000 open jobs. So employers are in a panic. But that's where I come in. My name's Carmen Hudson, and I stalk strangers online. I work for companies like Microsoft and Yahoo and Amazon, and my job is actually to find people who have these super skills and find a way to lure them into whatever company I'm recruiting for. So I do that by, first of all, figuring out what technologies they need to have. I figure out what companies they may work at, and then I do things like create crazy Boolean search strings on Google to find specific people. So let's say I'm looking for an engineer out of Square, the mobile payments company, and I want someone who has Ruby on Rails skills. I'll create a search string like that and come up with a guy like this, Jack Danger Canty. He's just begging to be stalked, right? So he's got his GitHub profile, and GitHub is a place where developers go to share information and collaborate and build code. He's got all of his information out there. I've got his email address, what kind of technology he's into. I might check out his LinkedIn profile because I need more than an email address. I want to get his phone number, and I want to learn more about him. So LinkedIn tells me that he's a UW grad, so he's working for Square down in Silicon Valley. But now I might be able to lure him up to Seattle because he's got a connection. There's his blog. He tells me a lot more about what he's into technically, more personal details. There's a link to his Twitter account. I love his Twitter account. He tells me everything. He likes cupcakes. He likes coffee. He's a raging liberal who likes to pay taxes. But here's the bonus, right? There is an entire list of other Square employees on Twitter as well. So there's 68 more people out of Square that I can stalk, right? So I absolutely love what I do. So I still don't have enough information. I don't have his phone number. So I'm going to check out some more stuff about Jack online. I'm going to look at his Quora account. I'm going to look at his SlideShare account. There's an article written about him. There's, you know, what conferences he's attended. I could stalk him in person if I wanted to, right? So I think at this point I'm starting to get enough information about Jack. But I did find his Flickr account, right? So I've got information about his family, his wife, his relatives, his vacations. It's starting to feel a little creepy, so I stop, right? I actually find his phone number, again, by constructing a simple little Google or Bing search, really looking up Jack Canty near, which is a Boolean command, area code 206. And there it is, his phone number. And guess what? That works about 50, 60% of the time. Your phone number's out there. If that doesn't work, I'll go to the Whois database. Every time you register one of those domain names for those startup businesses that you think about, and you don't pay the $15 to have your name secured, all of your information is easily accessible in an open and free database. okay? Or if that doesn't work, there are sites like Pipple and Zaba Search and My Life that allow me for very little money or for free to get your direct contact information. So I've got his contact information. I'm ready to reach out to Jack. Oh, I've got some other desperation tools, right? So if I can't figure out, Jack's phone number from these methods, I can use my email permutation tools, which really I just put his name in, and it comes up with all these sort of permutations about what his email might be. And so I can usually figure it out. Or, you know, if I really do have to go the physical route, I'll fire up my phone and I'll pull up Foursquare or Highlight and see if he's checking in or if any of his friends are checking in, and sit outside the company and track him that way. So I know everything I need to know before I make a phone call to Jack. I know that he's down in Silicon Valley. He's got a great job, great technical skills. He works for Square. But on top of that, I know that he likes coffee. He likes cupcakes. I know exactly how to bribe him. He has a good sense of humor, so when I call him, I can make him laugh. So I hope you learned a couple of things tonight. And that is, A, I love my job. B, in terms of internet privacy, if you're concerned about that, you leave digital breadcrumbs a lot on online, and you need to do more than a Google search to figure that out. And lastly, if you are looking for a job, you definitely want to make yourself visible, because people like me are looking for people like you. Thanks.
Thank you, Carmen. I think we learned a lot. So up next, we're going to hear from a speaker who's going to tell you about the ups and downs of urban farming in a talk she calls My Life of Poo. I'd like to welcome to the stage Diana Burgess-Vinn.
So my entire life, I've wanted to be a farmer ever since I was a little girl. Most little girls had dolls, but you know what I had? I had a saddle and a hoof pick right next to my bed. So one of the things that we got were goats, because goats are cool and awesome, and every farmer is supposed to have goats, right? So we got the goats, and we had to breed the goats, because you need to breed goats to get milk. This is Ophelia. When she went into heat, we took her up north to meet the buck of her dreams. And let me tell you, he was one handsome little guy. So 5 months later, on a really cold, blustery winter night, my husband and I helped deliver Biggie and Smalls. Biggie and Smalls were charming little fellows. You can guess which is Biggie and which is Smalls. Unfortunately, they were boy goats. If one of them had been a girl, we would have kept one. But because they were boys, I actually learned things like castration and all this other yucky stuff that hopefully none of you will have to learn. The goats were great. They gave great milk, wonderful fertilizing poop, and best of all, a sense of peace and calm in their warm, gentle presence. Now, I wanted to go in my backyard, and I wanted to be able to create a meal. So that meant getting chickens. And it was interesting. One place we lived, a neighbor actually put his pit bull in the coop twice because he wanted to teach the dog bloodlust. Next, we tried getting fertilized eggs, slipping them under a hen, and we got 8 roosters and 2 sickly hens that later died. But hey, you know, we learned, and the birds are great. Look at these sweet little ladies here. And let me tell you, homegrown eggs are beyond belief. They are the tastiest things imaginable. And it is really fun to go out in the morning. And if you have chicks, it's a great way to start the day. So here are some chicks, because you've got to renew your flock about every 2 to 3 years. There was recently an article about this, and sort of the downside of urban farming and chicken raising is you got to like do something with the old hens. So the other thing that's great is raising your own produce. I mean, it's really, really amazing to be able to go in the backyard and create a meal. One problem is everyone loves my produce. The crows, the slugs, neighbors walking past. And probably the person or the thing who likes my produce most is our family dog. this is Leo right after he has completely decimated my pea plants. And he's like, yeah, those peas are mine. You are not getting those peas. But, you know, you put up a fence and you kind of learn what to do. So another challenge, because I'm an Arizona girl, is figuring out the weather here. So finding what kind of things to grow, growing things indoors, and then best of all, using season extenders, which basically translates into a bunch of plastic. Here's my backyard in Columbia City, and I truly can go out in the backyard now, and I can kind of pick what I want. There's rhubarb, there's a bunch of raspberries, there's vegetables, there's herbs. But let me tell you, the best thing about urban farming is you get to play around with all the cool stuff that you grow. So we've pickled radishes, we've canned tomatoes, we've done beets, we've made yogurt, and of course, we've cooked up a storm. Now, we've already heard about the benefits of alcohol, and so we made some plum wine, and then we made some ginger beer, too. And the plum wine was actually from the neighbor's plum, so that was really awesome and fun to have that. Now, usually when most people think about urban farming, they think about the food side. But you can also grow all this cool stuff to make with. So you can grow plants to make natural dyes, you can make basket materials, essential oils, all that kind of stuff. So if you'd like to learn more about urban farming, or if you want to find out if we ever actually get off the grid, actually ditch the grocery store, there's a blog, urbanfarmhub.org. And I'd love to have people, if you have any specific questions, please shoot me questions. If you've got stories that you'd like to share, I'd love to hear your stories. And I promised my family I would not do animal imitations, so I'm done.
Thank you, Diana. So I think those of you who have kids know that they have so much energy and so much ability to experiment and be creative, and then something happens. So our next speaker, Teresa Harris, is going to tell you how you can teach your kids to fail. Teresa.
I want to teach your child to fail. I know when I say that to parents, I might as well tell them, I think your kid's ugly. It has that same impact. Parents don't want to associate the word failure with their child. They want to protect them from it. Learning how to fail, that's how our kids are going to learn to succeed. And if we allow them to experience the bumps in life, they'll figure out how to get where they want to go. Turns out, the kids under the age of 5, they're phenomenal at failing. My 4-year-old son is a great example. He builds this enormous tower, and it falls down around him. He throws this amazing tantrum, just thrashing on the floor, and then he's done. He doesn't phone a friend or consult a therapist. He turns his tears off, and he moves on. Little kids, they experience failure as information about what doesn't work. It still sucks for them, but they don't take it personally. A time will come when my son won't experience failure with this kind of resilience. In fact, at the age of 5, kids are using 80% of their creative potential. By the time they're 12, they're using just 2%. So why do we become less creative as we grow? We cultivate this fear of failure. Do you remember in grade school, those reading groups, were you put in the bluebirds group or the buzzards? For kickball, were you chosen first or last? If you're picked first, that's a lot of pressure. Last, I know it hurts. These moments, they leave indelible marks. Failure becomes about whether you're good enough, smart enough, not about what works. And the labels, they can become self-fulfilling prophecies that hold us back from doing something great, and instead, we play it safe, and we build that same Lego tower over and over again. I'm an art teacher, And I coach kids through their feelings of failure when they're learning to draw. Imagine an 8-year-old girl. She comes into the class. We're drawing horses. She's really excited. She's also nervous. Horses can be hard to draw. She sits down. She has her paper and her pen, and she draws an oval. It's going to be an eye. And then she starts to draw the ears, and she makes curved lines, and then she panics. She's made lines she doesn't like. Her self-doubt creeps in, and everything inside her wants to just scribble it out and throw it away. If we can slow down that moment and help her stay open, open to the idea of figuring it out, feel the discouragement and moving through it, something magic can really happen. She'll love that artwork far more than she would than if it came easy the first time. When you get stuck and unstuck, turning many failures into successes, that confidence accumulates. And her self-talk can change. It can change from, I can't, to I can. I am doing it. And if that shift happens, she may have the confidence to do anything she wants in life. Failure is not fatal. It gives life. It gives us life. And it gives our ideas life that without failure, those ideas wouldn't exist. The best way for our kids to learn to fail with resilience is to see us do it. Fail like you did when you first learned to ride a bike. Fall down. Show your kids your bruises. Let them see you try again. My name's Teresa Harris. And if you want information about Thrive Art classes, we're on the web. Thank you.
Teresa Harris, who spoke last month as part of Ignite Seattle. Her talk was called, I Want to Teach Your Child to Fail. In this segment, you also heard from Diana Vergis-Vinn and Carmen Hudson. The 20th Ignite Seattle event took place at Town Hall on May 16, 2013. It was moderated by Seattle Times columnist Monica Guzman. The next Ignite event is scheduled for August. You can learn more and hear the entire hour of this talk, as well as a list of speakers, by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Allie Ferguson recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Ignite Seattle in a moment, 844 94.9 KUOW. There are long-held stereotypes that only children are selfish, lonely, and spoiled, and they stay that way their entire lives. It's a stereotype that's existed for decades, penetrated many generations, and not only held in America, but in other countries. Lauren Sandler looked at the stereotypes and research and experiences of only children while writing her book, The Freedom of Having Only One Child and the Joy of Being One. Sandler looked at the correlation between religiosity and family size and the notions of what a traditional American family looks like and the societal pressure to have more than one child. Throughout her research, she came across the belief held by many that you are a bad person if you are an only child, and you are a bad person if you choose to have only one child. What does that look like inside the family? We'll talk with Lauren Sandler tomorrow during the noon hour. Weather forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows somewhere in the 50s and rain. Friday highs somewhere in the 60s, mostly cloudy, chance of showers. Friday night, lows in the 50s, partly cloudy, and Saturday highs lower to mid-70s, and all of a sudden, mostly sunny. Finn Dofay reads her poem Baritone Without a Body. Also, the gardening panel talks yard and garden care. And we'll hear a conversation about whether or not professional critics are relevant anymore in the age of Yelp and other websites that feature crowdsourced opinions. All three of those items next hour, beginning right after the 9 o'clock news.
KUOW and Pacific Northwest Ballet present Next Step, a choreographic showcase featuring emerging PNB talent and accompanied by the Seattle Youth Symphony Orchestras, June 14th at McCaw Hall. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Enlighten us, but make it quick. That's the premise of Ignite Seattle, a regular worldwide event where presenters get 5 minutes and 20 slides to get a point across. Speakers at the most recent Ignite talked about busking in Pike Place Market, stalking strangers online, and, coming up, hidden lessons in playing Ultimate Frisbee. The event took place at Town Hall on May 16, 2013. It was moderated by Seattle Times columnist Monica Guzman.
So we learn life lessons doing all kinds of things. Our next speaker is going to tell us what she learned playing Ultimate Frisbee. Welcome to the stage, Gina Phillips.
I was a painfully shy kid. I couldn't even order my own food in a restaurant, and my sister was my translator to the world. And I saw how she connected to people through sports, and I wanted that, and so I started to play sports too. And right before college, I discovered Ultimate Frisbee. And I fell in love with it and dedicated myself to it wholeheartedly, eventually captaining my college team and coaching and running leagues and clinics and captaining the Korea national team and being named MVP of some of the largest tournaments in Asia. And in total, I have competed in U.S. Nationals 7 times. And in every city that I've moved to, the ultimate community has been my way in to friendships, to recognition, to acceptance. And I was good at ultimate, like objectively good, and I wore that like a badge. And so when I moved to Seattle about a year ago, I expected that to work for me again. And so I tried out for the Seattle team, Riot, ranked 2nd in the nation, and I pushed through an injury and a lot of social anxiety for a month of tryouts. I really wanted it. But I didn't make it. I got cut. And in the ways that mattered, I wasn't good enough. And I feel some shame at that even now. And I remember the captain's well-intentioned advice that I should smile more and make more eye contact. So, and after that, I was ashamed to tell anybody that I had been rejected, especially those people who had watched me win those MVP trophies. And I felt fear. I felt fear that that people would think less of me, or that not only was I not good enough at Ultimate, but that people didn't like me enough. Fear that none of my Seattle plans would work out. And fear that if I had poured myself into this and it still wasn't enough, what did that say about me? I had an identity crisis. I was an Ultimate Frisbee player, and without that validated by this team, I was really shaken. And so all of that really sucked. And I cried about it when it happened. And I called my big sister, and she helped to pull me out of some of these negative thinking spirals I can get into. And I signed up for CrossFit. And I started competing. and I threw myself into work and networking and physical therapy, and another Seattle team asked me to play with them, and together we qualified for nationals for their first time. And I run now multiple networking groups, job fairs. I'm throwing a 1,000-person party next month. I have an app that's about to launch, and I've moved on, right? So it may sound like I've moved on, but in actuality, I was just setting myself up to make the same mistake, just with different activities. I hadn't really moved away from the real problem, which was that I was letting my sense of self-worth hinge on these external accomplishments. I was only as good as how good I was at these things, and that is a dangerous place to be. The day that I get injured and can't CrossFit anymore, the day that I make a mistake at work, the day that a guy turns me down, my sense of self-worth is going to nosedive. And I didn't even know that that was the way I was operating until I put together this talk, actually, with the support of some friends who are here tonight. And I... and I don't want to be that fragile. And so what I'm working on now is facing this self-knowledge and working on generating that sense of self-worth for myself. A sense of self-worth that I can carry with me no matter what, a sense of self-worth that no Frisbee team can say no to.
Thank you, Gina. Our next speaker is the last one of the first set, and he is going to tell you about his creation named Sir Mix-a-Bot, the robot bartender. Please welcome to the stage Dave Zucker. Dave.
So about 10 years ago, I was sitting at my desk at work when this big puppy dog of an intern came bounding in and said, "Dave, Dave, Dave, they're throwing away robot arms at school. Do you want one?" Well, duh. But just as soon as I got it, I felt this big pressure to do something with it, do something cool. I didn't want it to become a boat anchor or wind up in a junkyard, and I latched onto this idea of turning it into a bartender. So I started digging through what I got, and it turns out that mechanically, the arm was in great shape, but the electronics were from a different era, and they didn't work, and I wasn't going to be able to fix them. So I threw them away. And I started building up my own circuits to talk to the motors, not just to turn them forward and backward, but to communicate with the encoders that would tell me where, what the position of each joint was. And I put all of those circuits together, and I made a circuit board. And it almost worked. I'm a mechanical engineer, not an electrical engineer, and so after a bunch of frustration and trying things out, I had to scrap that idea. And so I bought some off-the-shelf motor controllers. There's six of them, one for each of the motors in the arm. And with a power supply and some other electronics, I was able to talk to each of the motors and make them turn. And that's when I brought in the big guns. This is my brother, Matt. He has a PhD in robotics. I could not have done this project without him. He helped me immensely. Specifically, he helped me write some software to do inverse kinematics, to translate from X, Y, and Z space into the joint angles. What was impossible for me was actually just a homework assignment for him in one of his graduate classes. So I built a bunch of software on top of the software that he made, and I did a lot of debugging. This is now stretched out over several years. Leading up to the end of last year, when I could finally control the arm, I could tell it where to go, and it actually went there. And for me, this is when it switched from a software problem to something that was a lot more fun. I'm a woodworker, and I had decided to make a custom veneered demi-lune table to serve as the base for this bartender. You saw pictures of the arm, the 1980 industrial chic look left a lot to be desired. So I kind of went to town on a pretty ornate base. This is the tabletop. It's made from sapele veneer. That's a wood that's a lot like mahogany. And it has a brass inlay as well as stringing. Those are the white lines made from holly. I made bottle holders. These are custom-made pieces of rolled brass that have these two wood blocks that keep the bottles propped up off the table so the robot arm can just go in and scoop it up and pick it up. And as much fun as it was to do a bunch of stuff in my own shop, I also got to take advantage of friends with cool toys. My buddy Avi got a new CNC mill this year, and we put it to good use making these custom inlay blocks that are the base of the table. So this is the arm on top of the table. The electronics live inside, and the top is hinged so you can lift it up for easy access. And then there's 10 bottle holders that surround the arm. And I picked different alcohols and mixers to maximize the number of drinks that the arm can make. This is the menu. It lives underneath a piece of touch-sensitive glass, just like you would find in a touchscreen, but instead of an LCD screen behind it, it's just a piece of paper. You can see the menu off to the right there. This is the arm making its very first drink. It made its debut at my birthday party earlier this year. Thank you. At that same party, I enlisted more help from friends to name the bartender. So there were a bunch of amazing submissions. R2DUI was a strong contender. Sir Mix-a-Bot won. So it is named Sir Mix-a-Bot, and I've really just been enjoying the whole process, the making, the sharing, and now it's really taken on a life of its own. It's gotten picked up by some tech blogs, and Sir Mix-a-Bot may be making an appearance on TV later this year.
Dave Zucker, who spoke last month as part of Ignite Seattle. His talk was called Sir Mix-a-Bot, the Robot Bartender. In this segment, you also heard from Gina Phillips. The 20th Ignite Seattle event took place at Town Hall on May 16th, 2013. It was moderated by Seattle Times columnist Monica Guzman. The next Ignite event is scheduled for August. You can learn more and hear the entire hour of this talk, as well as a list of speakers, by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Allie Ferguson recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
KUOW and the Shoreline Lake Forest Park Arts Council present the 23rd Shoreline Arts Festival, celebrating the creativity of artists and diverse cultures on June 29th and 30th. Learn more on the events page at kuow.org.
8:59 and change, KUOW FM 94.9 Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Grady. In a program on the theme, The Placebo Effect, we're going to learn about new research demonstrating the startling power of the placebo effect. Radiolab examines the chemical consequences of belief and imagination. Could the best medicine be no medicine at all? We'll take stock of the pharmacy in our brain.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.